The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is a giant poster of Luther's Small Catechism. It's perfect for display in your home, Christian day school, or Sunday school. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase the Small Catechism giant poster by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, the Small Catechism giant poster.
What this movie is saying is that women like being hurt and like being used, and that you as a man are entitled to use women. I just can't think of a worse thing to be teaching our young men.
The fallen world sniffs out this alien smell of the resurrection on you and will seek to stamp it out. It recognizes it for the threat that it is. The principle of this world is death.
If salvation is my personal relationship with Jesus, it makes our problem somehow having an emotional or personal distance from God. So it completely takes the idea of sin out of the question.
While snow blowing our driveways, hardy Minnesotans love to listen to Issues Etc.
Well, we know their names, Perpetua and Felicitas. We know a little bit about them. One of them was of noble birth in the Roman Empire, and at least according to legend, these women were martyred for converting to Christianity. Why was such a conversion considered illegal, even worthy of the death penalty at this time in Christian history? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Bill Weinrich is going to join us as we prepare to remember early 3rd century Christian martyrs Perpetua and Felicitas. The church remembers them on the 7th of March, and on this Wednesday afternoon, we'll do just that in advance. A little bit later, Richard Ausling will join us. We'll talk about media coverage of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's religious background and something that he has observed lately about the media coverage of the three Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Dr. Bill Weinrich is a regular guest. He joins us to remember Perpetua and Felicitas, 3rd century Christian martyrs. He's professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Weinrich, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Always good to be here.
These two women were imprisoned and eventually martyred for converting to Christianity under Roman Emperor Septimius Severus. Why was that conversion illegal or even declared illegal by that emperor?
Well, let me kind of rephrase your question. It's not so much that conversions were illegal as it was that the faith of Christianity was regarded as illegal or illicit. It's a somewhat complicated question. Let me just give a couple of aspects to this. First of all, in many ways, the Romans understood the consequences of something like the Christian faith. The Romans had multiple deities. In fact, in many ways, they were the most religious people ever existed. There were gods that inhabited fields and towns and houses. I mean, gods were everywhere. But Christianity was a universal faith and made universal claims. And that meant that it penultimatized all the deities that, according to the Roman mind, gave order to the Roman state and the Roman imperium. And so Christianity had a deeply corrosive effect upon the social order of the Roman Empire. And in fact, you mentioned Perpetua and Felicitas. This is very definitely seen in this narrative, where one of the most kind of touching scenes is where the magistrate brings before Perpetua her father, who pleads with Perpetua not to dishonor him, and with him the entire household. And so we see here in this act of the martyr how Christian faith, rooted in baptism, and a kind of a social restructuring in which our Father now is in heaven, the church is now our mother, fellow Christians are now our brothers and our sisters. That's a social restructuring. And And when you had something like the Roman Empire and the Roman mind, in which the Roman order, and in many ways that was based upon the paterfamilias and his overseeing of his household, that was seen as deeply destructive. So that's one important reason. And corresponding to this, the Christian refusal to acknowledge the emperor as having really divine function, or the Roman state itself as a manifestation of divine order, again, penultimatized the Roman claims concerning itself, that was the eternal Rome, or that the Roman Imperium was the exercise and appearance of divine order. The simple fact is, and I think maybe this is the best explanation to your question, the Christian faith penultimatized Roman political order, even as today it does as well.
So we're not talking about a strictly theological or a strictly, we would say today, political or civil concern that the Romans had about the burgeoning Christianity. It was a perfect mixture of those two in the way that they conceived of themselves as individuals, as citizens, as families, as society, as an empire.
Well, yeah, indeed. Our distinction between church and state, or the spiritual and the political, that never entered into the mind of man in the ancient world. Gods produced societies, and societies were understood to be ordered according to fundamental theological or divine principles and commandments. And that's why, for example, the Roman emperor became recognized and functioned cultically in terms of his public duties as the so-called Maximus Pontifex, or Pontifex Maximus, the highest priest. So there was just not only an intermingling, there was a kind of a mutual identification between the political order and theological conviction. When a country then or a people were captured or destroyed, it raised immediately questions about the power and reality of their deities. We see this already, by the way, in the Old Testament, in the prophet Ezekiel, where God tells Ezekiel that he sent Israel into exile, and because of that, his holy name is blasphemed amongst the nations. Obviously, if God is so great, how is it that his people are enslaved and we have destroyed his temple? A very good example of where political rising or political fallings had immediate impact upon claims about your God.
So how is it, what do we know of the lives of these two women martyrs, and how it is they came to their, well, one might say a sad end, but in the martyr's case, it's a victorious end, which we'll talk about a little bit here in a few minutes. What do we know about them?
Well, we don't know anything about them other than what we have in the Passion of Perpetua and Felicitas. They are, of course, not the only two martyrs that are in this passion. There are some others. These are the two female martyrs. Perpetua, we know from the language, was a young noble woman. She was a woman of some means, came from a family of some high society status. So we don't know exactly her father's name or her last name, but it's very clear that she was of, if you will, the more or less upper crust. On the other hand, Felicitas was a slave girl. Along with them were some male persons who were also arrested. A couple of them, Revocatus, Saturninus, Secundulus, They were both catechumens as well as already baptized figures. And then there's later a person by the name of Satyrus, who also is martyred. He was an already baptized Christian who voluntarily comes forward and declares himself Christian when he sees what's taking place with Perpetua and Felicitas. So we don't know too much about them. Another important aspect, however, is that Perpetua, we know, was a married young woman, had already born a child. We know that Felicitas was, the slave girl, was pregnant when she was enslaved and martyred. So that's just about all we do know about them in terms of their personal histories.
Dr. Bill Weinrich is our guest. We're remembering 3rd century Christian martyrs Perpetua and Felicitas. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
The faith once for all delivered to the saints. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in 2 different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit WittenbergAcademy.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about 3rd century Christian martyrs, Perpetua and Felicitas. The church will remember them on the 7th of March. Dr. Bill Weinrich of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is our guest. Dr. Weinrich, what would it have been like, one of these women is a slave girl, the other one's of noble family, what would it have meant for a woman of noble family to adopt this idea of Christianity that was considered so subversive to Roman ideas?
Well, as I mentioned, the fact that she proclaims a father who is in heaven utterly disenfranchises her earthly father as the source of her basic good. When Jesus, for example, says, "Let your treasure be where your heart is," for example, or in heaven, we kind of spiritualize that today. But in the first century, the second century, that had deeply social corrosive implications, that your inheritance, as First Peter says, is in heaven awaiting the appearance of Christ. No, your inheritance is in your father's hands. So for a young woman like Perpetua, especially of her social status, to declaim herself Christian was for her to be quite radical, revolutionary in terms of her conviction about the Roman order and all of the social constructs within that Roman order. So it's really to turn things upside down. And one of the reasons, as we noted previously, why Rome took a very, very harsh view to this.
Now, while their view is harsh, and this is a society that is red in tooth and claw, without a doubt, there is a, at least according to legend, in the martyrdom of these two, Perpetua and Felicitas, there's a reluctance. As we hear often in the, like the martyrdom of St. Polycarp, there's also an attempt on the part of the magistrate or some official to, we're going to give you a way out of this. We don't want to do this to you. You know, help us out here. There's a reluctance on the part of the Roman officials to carry this out, isn't there?
Well, to some extent it depends upon the particular martyr text one is reading. One finds this certainly, as you described it, in the martyrdom of Polycarp. It's not so prevalent in the Passion of Perpetua. Now, to be sure, the magistrate attempts to give Perpetua a way out. That's why he brings forward to her her father. But in this particular passion, these martyrs, Perpetua, Felicitas, and the others, are very steadfast and strike one as quite inflexible in their intent to be martyred if that entails apostasy or denying Christ. That's just not going to happen. And so they do come off as pretty stolid figures in this particular passion. Now, I think it's probably fair to say, and we need to keep this in mind, these Acts of the Martyrs were Christian productions. And they were, of course, intended to recount what happened, but they were intended to recount what happened precisely for the encouragement of the broader Christian community, that it also be emboldened to withstand persecution if that be necessary. And so the particular tenor and character of this or that aspect can vary from here to there. It is generally true to say, I think, that magistrates, especially when it came to Roman citizens, maybe not so much with slaves, but certainly with Roman citizens, and Vibia Perpetua certainly was one, the magistrate did not want to kill them, did not want to execute them, and would have found some way to give them an out. The most frequently cited within Acts of the Martyrs by Christian writers is deny Christ, you know, or sacrifice to the genius of the emperor. In other words, to acknowledge the primacy of the Roman order. And that was, of course, an out. Certainly Perpetua and Felicitas, Cundalus, Satyrus, and the others, they were going to have none of that.
Talk about the mindset of, and we're not talking about people who were born to Christendom, to the Christian faith, and had knew nothing else. These, as far as we can tell, were converts to the Christian faith. Talk about the fervor that led even converts to be willing to subject themselves to the martyr's sword.
Well, it's a very good question, and it's hard always to answer that with any certainty. It is, of course, remarkable that Christianity in those days, and many places today, as we are hearing from the news, is a dangerous thing. And that meant that Christianity was understood to give something that was worth dying for. And there was a tremendous sense of freedom, of identity satisfaction, if you will, that my being has a transcendental root that cannot simply be defined by the political order or the economic order or whatever pluses or minuses happen to occur in this life. There is what we might call a transcendental and eschatological character to the human person that transcends anything that can happen here, and that means maybe one dies in order to witness to it. But there was certainly a sense of freedom. I mean, for a person like Vibhya Perpetua, she was, strictly speaking, losing every good thing that her station in life, which was considerable, could offer to her. And she was losing, in addition to that, her life itself. That meant that the Christian faith had to be extremely attractive. And I think it's a message for today, perhaps, that what really Christianity gave to the ancient world in some kind of summary fashion was a sense of the transcendental goodness of things. And with that, then, a fundamental notion that there was hope and that there was a truth that was loving. And when things are kind of collapsed upon the imminence of the natural political cycles, those things are not so evident. So I think it was this sense of release from trepidation, from servitude to the cosmos, to the political forces. Paul speaks of it in what is it, Ephesians, doesn't he? That we, you know, these heavenly powers and the stoicheia in the heavens. Those were real powers. We don't have this sense today, which might mean that we're simply today so spiritually endangered, actually.
And talk about the other end of the equation, and that is we're talking about these two women who were martyred in the very early 3rd century because their martyrdom was remembered among the many other martyrs, as you mentioned before. Not so much because it was unique. What was it about martyrdom for the earliest Christians, kind of woven into their way of thinking about what it meant to be a church, what it meant to be Christians individually?
Well, it's a very good question, and in many ways you're asking why martyr texts were written at all. We have some very good answers to that within some of these texts. At the end of the martyrdom of Polycarp, for example, it becomes very clear, and we know this from other texts concerning Perpetua and Felicitas' story. These texts were very early on read to the church, certainly at the anniversary of their martyrdom, and, as seems to be the case, as part of a liturgical context, perhaps even a Eucharistic one. With angels and archangels and with all the hosts of heaven kind of an idea. We see this in the Te Deum, don't we? All the martyrs praise thee, the apostles praise thee in them. And so they became kind of this cloud of witnesses that lies not external to the reality of the earthly church, but indeed lies internal to the reality of what we might call the earthly church. And so, in fact, it was the martyr who manifested the deep truth about Christian reality. That's why they were called martus or martyrs. They were not called, and this is an important point, actually, they were not called martyrs because they had given a verbal confession of Christ before the magistrate. Those persons were called confessors. The martyr was a martyr precisely in his or her death. The death was the martyrdom. The death was the witness. And so they were called martyrs because they manifested in the most extreme fashion. By extreme, I don't mean unreasonably extreme. I mean the final, most perfect fashion that Christian faith calls you to a commitment to that which is not of this world. It calls you to a commitment of faith and trust in God the Creator, who gives life, sustains it, and that life finally has meaning only in Him. That was the witness. So death is conquered by death. In a strange way, then, for the martyr and for the church in viewing the martyr, The resurrection of Christ was manifested in the death of his saints, because in their death, in which they willingly undertook death, rather than deny him, they were testifying that there was a life that was laying underneath and all around their own demise. And in many ways, that I think is the martyr, kind of the mindset of the martyr. The martyr was, in many, more than the bishop, the martyr was the icon of the Christian church. The church really had as its icon the martyr. And, of course, the primary martyr was Christ. And so some of these martyr stories, Polycarp is a good example, are actually patterned, the Passion of Cyprian, another one, actually patterned on the Passion story of Jesus, because they were the very image of the crucified Jesus. And by the way, if you read the Passion of Perpetua, you will see this concerning herself as well. She becomes as a man in the arena as she fights the Egyptian. Well, that just means that the martyrdom of Perpetua was seen to be, when everything is said and done, it was a contest between Satan and Christ. Who's going to win out in this person called Perpetua? And when Perpetua accepts martyrdom, then the verdict is given. She goes through the Yana Vivarium, the gate of the living. Now, in the actual arena, the gate of the living is where the gladiator who had survived the contest went. And so, here's kind of this upside downness of the martyr story. Clearly, Perpetua is dead, but she is said to walk victoriously through the Yana Vivarium, through the gate of the living. Well, indeed, from the perspective of the church, that's exactly what happened.
We'll take a break when we come back. A few more minutes with Dr. Bill Reinwick of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking about third century Christian martyrs Perpetua and Felicitas.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Hi, this is Pastor Clayton from Zion Lutheran Church of Muscoota, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Zion is a congregation firmly grounded in God's grace given in the Word and Sacraments, where we treasure the timeless beauty of the liturgy. Zion is also a vibrant, young, family-friendly congregation where you would be warmly welcomed. Zion is located at 101 South Railway Street in Muscoota, Illinois, and we would love to share God's gifts of grace with you. For more information, please visit our website at zionmuscoota.com.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Historic. Authentic Christian radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We now have 7 Spanish language transcripts of Issues Etc. that you can download for free.
Ahora tenemos 7 transcripciones en español de Issues Etc. que se puede descargar gratis.
These broadcast transcripts cover the 6 chief parts of Luther's Small Catechism and include a teaching on why do bad things happen.
Estas transcripciones cubren las 6 partes principales del Catecismo Pequeño de Lutero e incluyen una enseñanza que se llama ¿Por qué pasan las malas cosas?
Guests include Matt Harrison, Peter Bender, and Carl Fickenscher.
Los invitados incluyen Matt Harrison, Peter Bender, y Carl Fickenscher.
You can download and print these Spanish transcripts for free. Just go to issuesetc.org and click Publications.
Se puede descargar e imprimir estas transcripciones en español gratis. Solo vaya a issuesetc.org y haz clic en publicaciones.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is a book laid out in giant poster form. It's the familiar text of Martin Luther's 16th century Small Catechism. It is the basic handbook of the confessional Lutheran Christian, and it's in the form of a giant poster. It comes from Concordia Publishing House. This is actually a very old idea. They used to do this all the time in the earlier days of the Lutheran Reformation and of Lutheran history. They would lay these things out as a way to have always before us these essential truths of God's Word that are essential to the life and the devotion of the Christian. It's the giant poster of Luther's Small Catechism, The Issues Etc., Book of the Month for March. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order the giant poster of Luther's Small Catechism, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. For the next few minutes, we're remembering early 3rd century Christian martyrs Perpetua and Felicitas that the Church remembers on the 7th of March. Dr. Bill Weinrich is our guest. Before the break, Dr. Weinrich, you were talking about what you call the upside-downness of the martyr story, these martyrs' deaths being viewed not so much as deaths, but as contests of Satan and Christ, with Christ remaining victorious even over their death. Have we lost that idea in the Church today?
Well, I think perhaps we have, but we had darn well better recapture it, shouldn't we? Not too long ago, I saw on my Facebook a wonderful new icon on the 21 new martyrs of Syria, right? Who have now even gotten a kind of their own feast day in the Syrian Orthodox calendar. That's the recent 21 Syrians who were beheaded because they were Christians. We have more martyrs going on today than ever before. And as we begin to see also in our own culture, where living out Christian conviction can cost you home and business and money and public reputation and the rest, this will require that we come again to terms with what is the value of the Christian faith. Do we really see in it something that defines our life in a fundamentally determinative, guiding fashion, apart from which our life really doesn't count? Or is it some sort of add-on to other add-ons in our life, that we're Republicans or Democrats, but I'm also a Christian? It's not, Christianity is not an association. It's a definition of one's identity. And this, by the way, Todd, makes baptismal thinking all the more crucial for our teaching. We've got to understand baptism as constituting the human person anew, as one who is oriented to God. And that's why, as you know, martyrdom was called the baptism of blood. And if you were not, like these catechumens, if you had not yet been baptized in water, martyrdom sufficed. It united you to the crucified Jesus. So whether we've lost it or not, we can debate that. But one thing is clear, I think our future demands that we had better get a really firm grasp on it.
Before we let you go, Dr. Weinrich, Concordia Theological Seminary there in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is going to be hosting an event called Prayerfully Consider, March the 19th through the 21st. Why should a man considering the pastoral ministry or a woman considering the vocation of deaconess in the church visit the campus there at Concordia Theological Seminary?
Well, let me answer that question this way. When Christianity became legal, the rhetoric of martyrdom passed over to the monk and the nun. They were perpetually being martyred, as it were. How so? Because they had given up the world for Christ. And perhaps we can think something like that for those who want to be pastors and deaconesses. Yes, it is true. You can make more money, perhaps have a higher social status if you are a doctor, lawyer, or something like that. But if, like the martyr, you want your whole life, not just part of it, but indeed your vocation, that which constitutes your daily activity, as oriented to God in a quite specific fashion, then being a pastor and being a deaconess is a very good way to do that. You're simply, in a way, might I say it this way, in a way that is different from being a Christian plumber or a Christian doctor. I'm not saying they don't do good works, and of course they do, but when you're a pastor, your entire vocational self is oriented towards the end, which is God, as it is for the deaconess work. And so I think this little time at our seminary in the next weeks where people can visit if they are thinking about being a pastor or being a deaconess, I think it's a great way to kind of conclude our discussion on martyrdom. In a way, you sacrifice. In fact, I just went to class not too long ago. 1 hour ago, I was in class. There are men in that class who would be making a lot more money than they ever will, but they decided to be a pastor. Now, that's giving something up, and I can only say how much I respect that vocational choice.
Folks, you can find out more about the prayerfully considered visit March the 19th through the 21st at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155. Dr. Bill Weinrich is professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Weinrich, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, always a pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
When we come back from this break, the press has a role to play. The media have a role to play in the vetting of our politicians, especially if they're aspiring, perhaps, to the highest office in the land, the president's office. And there is a particular Republican man, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin, who is at least kind of testing the waters in that respect. And the press is doing its task in helping to vet him with a certain amount of questions that they have for him that they reserve for generally Republicans who are Protestant evangelicals, as is Scott Walker. Are they doing their due diligence? We'll answer that question on the other side of the break as we talk about media coverage of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's religious background and the three Abrahamic religions. Richard Osling, longtime religion writer for the Associated Press and Time magazine, will be our guest. Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Epiphany Lutheran Church in Door, Michigan gathers to receive our Lord's gifts in word, baptism, and supper every Sunday morning at 9:15. Bible study at 11. Join us at 4219 Park Lane in Door, or visit us on the web, epiphanydoor.org. Christ-centered, cross-focused, historic, confessional, liturgical. Epiphany Lutheran Church in Door, Michigan. epiphanydoor.org. 616-681-0791.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Zion Lutheran, Muscoda, Illinois. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Grace Lutheran, Auburn, Michigan. Zion Lutheran, Pleasant Plains, Illinois. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word, Rochester Hills, Michigan. Zion Lutheran, Laramie, Wyoming. Redeemer Lutheran, Seymour, Indiana. Zion Lutheran, East Moline, Illinois. And Peace Lutheran, South St. Louis County. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.